inflation. People think that hyperinflation could never happen in this country, but of course it could, and the chances of it happening are increasing all the time, especially over the last year or so. The uncomfortable fact is that hyperinflation is actually a pretty frequent phenomenon, and I was actually shocked when I looked into this that most major countries have experienced it at some point in the last 200 years. Examples include China periodically and the various emperors. Of course, they pioneered paper currency in China. France after the French Revolution. America during the Civil War. Russia post the 1918 revolution. And again, after the collapse of communism in the early 90s. Germany, Austria, Hungary, and Poland after World War I. Japan after World War II. Yugoslavia recently during the breakup, Brazil and Israel in the 80s, Congo, that's the Democratic Republic, which used to be called Zaire, was almost constantly undergoing hyperinflation over the last 30 or 40 years. And of course, more recently we've seen terrible hyperinflation in Zimbabwe. I'm going to start by attempting to define hyperinflation, and then go on to look at how economic theory seeks to explain the phenomenon. Then move on to the wider social and economic effects using historical examples, in particular Germany in the 1920s, just because that's the most well-documented example. Interestingly, both Hayek and Mises would have lived through the hyperinflation of that period, which of course also afflicted Austria very badly. So I think this possibly explains their deep distrust of government-controlled money. Finally, in the light of the historical evidence, and also some further theoretical insights, I will address the possibility that hyperinflation could hit Western countries within the next decade. Now, firstly, the definition. There's no precise definition of hyperinflation. Some say 50% a month inflation. Others say 100% a year. I think I'll stick with 100% a year because I think that's bad enough, to be honest. Of course, there are issues about how inflation is measured, what to include in an index, how to account for quality improvements and so on. Of course, there have been accusations that governments have been fiddling inflation figures over the years as a corollary overstating economic growth. So even using the official figures, of course, the dollar has lost about 96% of its value since 1913, and the pound, I think even more, probably 98% of its purchasing power. There's also, it's important to remember, there's also a change in the meaning of inflation since the 19th century. It used to simply mean an increase in the supply of money, whereas now it's widely understood as a decrease in the purchasing power of money. In other words, now it's understood as prices going up. It actually used to mean the process of increasing the money supply. So now onto the economic theory. It's obviously normal for individual prices to change as part of the market process. But when prices go up in general, this is often caused by governments issuing additional money when the growth of money exceeds the growth in goods and services. Indeed, in the absence of government money creation, you would probably expect it would be normal for prices to fall gradually, as explained in the book Less Than Zero by George Selgin. And this is because productivity is generally increasing, so you'd expect a gradual fall, even probably under a gold standard, because the supply of new gold is relatively small relative to the overall stock of gold. Another cause of general price rises is what Mises calls dishoarding, which in modern terminology would be an increase in the velocity of money. In other words, each pound or dollar would be used to do more work, to buy more stuff. It sort of spins around the economy more quickly. And this has a similar effect on prices to increasing the amount of money. Now, this occurs when people decide to actually spend their cash. Or with electronic money, it can be affected by the level of bank lending. So the recent so-called credit crunch is actually associated with a collapse in the velocity of money as banks held on to their reserves instead of lending it out. Of course, it's not just governments that can create money, also banks can do so through the fractional reserve system. So if someone makes a £100 deposit in a bank, which has what's called a reserve ratio, so it has to keep, say the reserve ratio is 10%, it has to keep £10 of that money. They can then lend out £90 of that money, which then gets deposited in another bank. And then if they want the 10% reserve ratio as well, then they can lend out £81 of that. And so you have money created through the banking system. This is actually constrained by, for example, banks' own assessments of whether the loans are a good idea and the chances of repayment. Also various financial regulations. And the main thing is probably the central bank setting interest rates to control, try and restrain bank lending. Alternatively, in a high sort of free banking system, you would have competition between the banks, perhaps issuing different currencies, so they would have restraints in terms of the banks competing on the soundness of their own money. Now, in theory, a general decline in the supply of goods and services could also produce a decline in purchasing power. Though in practice, it's difficult to see how this can happen. So external shocks can raise some prices, say, like oil. But given a constant quantity of money and no change in the velocity of money, then other prices would fall. For example, labour-based services in the economy would fall as a consequence. Also, you'd find that demand for the oil would then fall as the price went up, and substitutes would be found. And also, as a result of the price increase, this would actually reduce the weight of the oil in the overall economy. So there are sort of feedbacks that prevent sort of a general price rise. Now, as with a normal reduction in purchasing power, the main economic cause of hyperinflation is the creation of additional money, in particular governments issuing additional money. Now, what tends to happen is that instead of funding public spending through borrowing or taxes, they print money or create it electronically. Expectations then play a critical role. So as governments monetize their debts, debasing their currency in the process, individuals lose confidence in the money. More and more people expect its purchasing power to decline. And then you get what Mises called the flight to real goods. So people want to get rid of their money. Money becomes a hot potato, basically. Everyone wants to reduce their cash holdings.
Worth less than a hot potato.
Yes. And this flight to real goods occurs as people exchange money for tangible goods. And this causes what Mises called a cracker boom. So suddenly increasing consumption. Eventually, the transaction costs of money rise to such an extent that it is actually rendered useless, and new forms of money such as gold, foreign currency, or even things like cigarettes are used instead, along with barter, so all kinds of things. In the meantime, high rates of inflation have made economic calculation almost impossible, and this means that there are huge malinvestments taking place. Accordingly, the later stages of hyperinflation and the subsequent stabilisation are generally marked by a painful adjustment process as these malinvestments are liquidated, and also governments have to slash spending and raise taxes to end the need for monetization. Now, this theory has all been a bit cold, so now I'm going to start looking at the historical details, which are pretty grisly, and I think only then you sort of start to appreciate the true terror of hyperinflation. Now, the first sign of trouble in Germany was the abandonment of the gold standard in 1914, so that was at the start of World War I. The government then borrowed and printed money rather than raising taxes to pay for the war, and by 1917 the amount of money in circulation had risen fivefold. But the main surge in prices happened after the war in 1919. Individuals had been hoarding cash, basically that in times of crisis people tend to hoard, and obviously the war was such a situation. Another factor may have been that there were few sort of consumer goods available, so perhaps there wasn't really that much to buy. Then in 1919, after peace came, money came flooding back into the economy, the velocity of money exploded, so money started spinning around the economy, and prices rose by 300% in that year. So we had hyperinflation in 1919 already. Then, of course, people lost confidence in the currency, and this wasn't helped by the Treaty of Versailles, which imposed huge reparation costs on Germany. This wasn't actually the cause of the hyperinflation, but it did undermine confidence in the currency. The flight to real goods began, and the hyperinflationary process accelerated. So what was the government? The problem with the government was that it was committed to maintaining its spending levels as far as possible. And of course, once we'd already got 300% inflation, I'll use the term inflation, a 300% decline in purchasing power. It had a problem collecting taxes, of course, because taxes are generally set at the start of the financial year, and then, so in sort of real terms, the taxes were pretty worthless. So it was kind of a process that spiralled out of control and fed on itself. Eventually, of course, the government ended up adjusting taxes every month. But another problem was companies started using foreign currency accounts actually outside of Germany to avoid paying tax, and obviously to avoid holding marks. So the importers and exporters would use these foreign currency accounts for doing their business. And so it actually made tax avoidance even easier. And obviously, as more and more people use barter, that also made tax collection very difficult. Now you've got to look at the political context, and Germany faced enormous political instability at the time. It was a nascent democracy, but in those days, I think in one single year, probably 1920, there were about 300 political assassinations. The communists were on the rise. Obviously, the National Socialists were just starting to get angry. Also, the French were trying to break up the country and establish a Rhenish Republic in the West. Eventually, the French invaded the Ruhr. This was in 1923. In retaliation for default on war reparations. And this was Germany's industrial heartland. And so revenues collapsed because of that. But the good German government continued to fund what was called the Ruhrkampf, which was a struggle to kick the French out sort of with passive protest. And they continued paying dole benefits for workers, unemployed workers in the Ruhr. So it was a huge drain on resources. So now some figures. At the end of 1922, the cost of living had risen by 1,500 times since the war, while wages on average had probably gone up around 200-300 times, so actual living standards were falling calamitously by then. But the real disaster was yet to come. So the figures are for a cost of living index, which is set at 1 in 1914 at the start of World War I. And by September 1923, this index had risen to 15 million. By October 1923, it was 3,657 million. And by November 1923, when the mark was finally abandoned, it had risen to 218,000 million. So it's absolutely astounding what we're looking at here. At this stage, only 1% of the government's budget was funded by taxes. 99% was by printing money. And what did this mean in practice? In the last months of the mark, people would queue outside banks with buckets and wheelbarrows because so much currency was required to buy basic goods. Local authorities and large firms were allowed to issue their own notes in lieu of marks because there was such a shortage of notes. In the worst period, a cup of coffee that cost 5,000 marks would cost 8,000 marks by the time it had been drunk. Diners' restaurant bills would rise as they ate. Newspapers would list tram prices and taxi fares every single morning because they changed so quickly. Thieves would steal baskets and buckets full of money but leave the money behind in containers because the money was so worthless. And obviously, well, businesses didn't quite well to start with in the cracker boom. This played hell with their economic calculation, and they sort of started to shut down en masse. You actually had a famine in the large cities, which not many people know, and people had to eat rats and dogs to survive. the problem wasn't a poor harvest, it's just the farmers wouldn't exchange their food for worthless currency, so that was the main problem. Actually, the farmers did rather well out of the hyperinflation, because many of them had fixed rate mortgages set before the war, which basically dwindled to roughly the price of a single egg, whereas they could barter food for luxury goods. So you'd find cars, which were then a very, you know, real luxury item on farms. The farmers' wives would be wearing fur coats and loads of jewellery, and they had grand pianos, which of course was a great status symbol at the time. Whereas the urban middle classes saw their wealth almost completely destroyed by the inflation, because they ended up selling their sort of antiques and valuables for food and basic goods. Those relying on savings income were particularly vulnerable, and they often ended up in the soup kitchens and able to afford even to feed themselves. As an aside, it was almost impossible to protect one's wealth. There is a mania of investing in shares, obviously, is to try and hedge against the fall in purchasing power. But by 1923, the shares were trading at a tiny fraction of their 1914 value. So people generally lost 90% plus on the shares when you measured the shares value in pounds or gold. And in terms of purchasing power, it was probably close to sort of 98%, something like that. Also, landlords renting property was a disaster as well, because the government imposed rent control, so the rents couldn't keep up with the rising prices. And so in terms of hard currency, the property prices collapsed, and American students who were in Berlin could buy whole blocks of houses with just their students' allowance from the States. It got so bad. Yeah, the best inflation hedges are probably gold and foreign currency, and both were in high demand during the hyperinflation. Though even with these, you would tend to lose significantly in terms of purchasing basic goods. Of course, things like the pound and the franc had also lost purchasing power hugely during the First World War as well. They're not to the same extent as the mark. I think probably the best hedge was possession of tangible goods, basic goods like coffee, sugar and fuel. Not to mention food-producing land, which I mentioned earlier. These were the surest insurance policies against hyperinflation. In the initial stages, the working classes did quite a bit better than the middle classes. They received more frequent wage increases thanks to the political power of the unions. But eventually they lost out as the factories and coal mines closed down towards the end of the hyperinflation period. And then they ended up on a pittance of unemployment, which towards the end couldn't be raised in line with prices. Entrepreneurs, particularly currency speculators, often did well, and those who could obtain foreign currency could pick up assets at bargain prices. There was huge resentment about their success, while most people were borderline starving in the big cities. And this led to an increase in anti-Semitism, because a significant proportion of the successful trades were Jewish. And I think this can probably be explained because they often had relatives abroad, so they could get hold of foreign currency more easily and do the trades. So they had these extended kinship networks. And obviously that sowed the seeds of the terrible events later on in Germany. Now, given this boiling cauldron of unrest, suffering and resentment, it's unsurprising that there were events like riots and protests, etc. Linz in Austria, which is, I think, second or third biggest city in Austria, perhaps, was plundered by a raging mob who looted all the shops and smashed them up as well. They didn't just steal everything in the shops, they smashed them up, set them on fire. And food shops were looted in Berlin, and there were riots in just about every German city. Parties of workers would go out of the cities to raid farms, and they'd kill the animals, tear the meat from them, and also get rid of the crops. And they wouldn't just loot the farms, they'd also destroy the farms, set them on fire. Such was the rage about the inequalities that had grown up. Predictably, all this unrest led to a government crackdown. And in September 1923, seven articles of the Constitution were suspended, and a state of emergency was announced. This led to restrictions on personal liberty, freedom of expression, freedom of the press, and freedom of association. I think at one stage they had a law where they could confiscate any foreign currency. So they'd go around the posh restaurants in Berlin and search everyone in the place, and then, you know, pick up a few dollars here and there for the government. The army and the police could interfere with the post and the telephone services. They could search houses at will, confiscate property. Incitement to disobedience was punished with imprisonment or a huge fine. They also introduced a death penalty for ringleading armed mobs, treason, arson, or damage to the railways. So perhaps apart from that last bit, it was more or less new Labour policies. Now, these are the kind of developments we can look forward to if hyperinflation comes to Britain over the next few years. Except I would say it would probably be actually far worse, and the reasons are this. The division of labour is now far more specialised, and the impact of destroying this through hyperinflation would actually be greater, and accordingly the rush to totalitarianism would be quicker, for example, to control food supplies, and this will be aided by the new technology which makes such control far easier. Also, I think, corrupted by the welfare state, far more people live hand to mouth now, with little in savings, and also the decline in the extended family probably means much less informal support in bad times. So what should we look out for? What are the warning signs? I think the economic theory only goes so far. Clearly the monetization of debt is one element, and this is occurring at an unprecedented rate as we speak through various quantitative easing programs. We're also entering uncharted territory regarding the velocity of money and the rate at which bank lending recovers in the near future. It could happen very quickly, and if it does so, the central banks could be caught on the hop. And that's a problem with monetarism. They're always dealing with history in terms of the dates they use to make decisions. So there could be a sudden surge. Then there's the level of government borrowing, which in the US and the UK is at the worst annual level since World War II. In the US, this is scary. About half the money the federal government is spending this year and next will be borrowed. And this is actually worse than some of the countries that hit hyperinflation in the early 20s. I think the Hungarian government was only borrowing a third of its spending, so it was relatively prudent compared with the US federal government. In the UK, it's not quite so bad. It's more like a quarter, but it's bad enough. It's you know, far, far higher than at any time since World War II. Now, if this public spending isn't brought under control, then there's always a temptation that the politicians will go for monetization. And this is where I think public choice theory and the economic theory of politics can actually add to our initial theoretical understanding, which was broadly based on Austrian economic theory. Because cutting public spending in the short term harms particular powerful interest groups. For example, public sector workers, those on welfare benefits, state pensioners, those dependent on government contracts as well. If politicians rely on these groups to maintain power in the short run, they are unlikely to make the needed cuts in public spending, even if this risks inflation later on. In the UK, these client groups are now huge. So I think 20% of the working population work directly for the government. Around 16 or 17% are on out-of-work benefits. Then you've also got the state pensioners as well. And those that work for the state, but ostensibly for the private sector, but really for the state. So, you know, some of these traffic wardens or whatever, subcontractors, etc. I suppose, yeah, if you include tax credit recipients, you're looking at quite a large majority of the population. And most of these people, who you could say were sort of Labour's core vote and beyond, have no significant savings and basically live hand to mouth. And then there's the regional element. the cities outside the southeast where public spending is 60 or 70% of the economy. In other words, there's basically no real economy, maybe a retail sector, but all that does is basically feed off the spending of the government workers and benefit claimants and pensioners, etc. So cutting spending would lead to a prolonged and severe slump for these areas. The private sector couldn't compensate because of probably the regulations would limit the growth of the private sector to a fairly low rate. Things like the minimum wage, planning controls, etc. So in these circumstances, cutting public spending is going to be an absolute nightmare. And then there are also these hordes of uneducated young people who until now have been soaked up in government jobs and sort of colleges and universities. So under these circumstances, I mean, politicians are going to think, well, wouldn't it be easier to impose a hidden tax on the middle classes, on middle class savers, than make these cuts and cause all this political turmoil? So that's the temptation that's there. But such a scenario wouldn't lead to hyperinflation, probably would lead to sort of a 70s-style stagflation. The other alternative, of course, is a Japan-style extended slump. And you're probably looking at this kind of scenario if say, the Conservatives, assuming they get in, they raise taxes by quite a lot and also cut spending, but at the same time do nothing to deregulate the economy, actually keep piling on the regulations and, you know, have all the global warming stuff going on. So then we're probably looking at, you know, less than 1% economic growth a year, sort of very low growth for the next few years or so. The zombie banks are another issue, of course, so that won't help either, probably. But I think for hyperinflation to occur, I think some sort of external shock would be necessary. One possibility would be a major conflict in the Middle East that sent energy prices up to, say, oil up to $500 a barrel. And this would then tempt Western governments to print money to protect hard-hit interest groups. And they'd be tempted because this would be in the context of already extremely high borrowing levels, so they have very little room for manoeuvre. And such a shock could also spook the bond markets, leading to a rise in interest rates, at which point, when the governments are borrowing so much, the governments have difficulty repaying the interest on their existing debt. So there's a potential debt spiral there. Also, a conflict with China is a particular worry for the United States because the Chinese hold such a huge amount of US Treasury debt. So Taiwan's another potential flashpoint. Even if it's just a diplomatic spat, it could spell trouble for the bond market. Of course, there's no intrinsic reason why such shocks should cause high inflation or even hyperinflation, providing governments were prepared to exact emergency spending cuts. But whether they can actually do this in the light of very strong pressure groups is another issue. I want to end on a final note of caution, and that's that I did read that Lenin supposedly deliberately used hyperinflation to destroy middle-class power in the early 20s. I don't know whether that's correct, but I did read that. So if we do get hyperinflation, some kind of political revolution is likely to come with it. So as we enter the first stage of terrible economic turmoil, we should be all on our guard. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Richard. Is there any questions, John?
A very practical and self-interested question. If I buy a house now, it's a very expensive house. Is hyperinflation going to benefit me, or is the mortgage rate going to go up so much that I'm wiped out and I probably have to sell the house?
Well, the right answer is consult an independent financial advisor. No, I think one way people can protect themselves against inflation is to get a fixed, long-term fixed-rate mortgage. They're not as easy to get in this country as they are in the States. But I believe you can get a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage from one building society.
Deposit.
Yeah, with quite a high deposit. But I think you can get them.
Yeah.
So that's... If you believe,
that's a year.
But the problem is you've got to balance the risk, because if you've got some sort of Japan-style slump, then you know, it's not great to have a fixed rate. It'll be probably higher than the variable rate. So. Mm.
sort of building on that idea, I guess one of the interesting things to debate is when we're, you know, if we expect hyperinflation, obviously with the Federal Reserve doubling the monetary base in 1 year, it's going to have consequences. But I guess timing is a key issue. The fact that the housing markets and the stock markets have been, well, during the crash, have wiped out so much electronic money on books, is this a sort of blessing in disguise, the fact that it will delay the effects of hyperinflation until the monetary base starts to circulate within the banking system?
I'm not sure how relevant that is, really. It might actually tempt the banks to welcome some sort of moderate inflation in terms of supporting their asset prices. It all depends on this sort of money multiplier, how quickly the monetary base then gets translated into how quickly the velocity of money increases. Basically, I think the central banks are walking a tightrope, and if they just get it slightly wrong, then you could get tipped in either direction. But it's difficult to predict.
Well, something of a paradox. In the, I believe in the 1920s, the German bank insisted that it couldn't create money fast enough. There was such a demand for money that they had to keep taking the stuff out.
That's right. Well, actually, what confused me at the time was that the amount of money in circulation in terms of gold had actually gone down. So they thought, well, this can't be inflationary. But they hadn't factored in properly the way it was spinning around the economy, the way the velocity of money had increased so enormously. And that was what was driving the problem, the loss of confidence and the expectations of losing purchasing power. So there's a misunderstanding of what was going on. I think that's why they were so reluctant to actually stop the printing presses until, I think it was Schacht became the Minister of Finance, who went on to serve under Hitler, I think, but he was the chap that got it under control.
Have you heard of a chap called Professor Feketer, Antal Feketer?
No.
He's an Austrian, he's a gold standard guy, Austrian top economist, and with your point, he says the same thing. He says that he calls it the marginal utility of debt. He wasn't the guy that brought it up. But for every extra dollar that's added of debt, that's added into the economy, it reaches a point eventually where you don't get an extra dollar of GDP coming out of it, or a multiplier of GDP coming out. You actually get a shrinking of GDP for every extra dollar of debt. And you get the economy contracting, and all the money is going into pay the interest on the debt, which leaves no money left, no physical money left over, and you end up, the printing press is running white hot, can't keep up with the demand for money because the interest payments are so humongous.
Strange thing there is, why don't they simply print higher denomination notes?
Yeah.
Why not simply more of the same? Why?
Yeah.
That's
a mitigator. Well, it's lovely. They add denominations to just shrink the amount of packs of money needed to carry on for practical reasons, and eventually come to a point where they just slash it off because they're ruined on the paper.
Yeah. Well, they usually do have, they overstamp notes with more noughts, that kind of thing.
Yes, that's very naughty.
Eventually, you've got to put the powers to the power of it all breaks down.
It's a rather amusing
a continuation. Until recently, of course, there was not a demand for paper for making banknotes. In Zimbabwe, of course, they were using more and more until they started putting more notes on, which they like to do. And the firm they were getting the notes from, or the paper for the notes, was a certain Austrian or German firm that supplied the Weimar Republic. So it's, you know, stick to what you know best.
I remember reading actually that I think they employed about 300 factories to print the notes at one stage in Germany. It's a huge operation.
Gadsden Hughes told us that the people used to have an Austrian understanding of deflation. just wondered what you read that showed that was true or not. I just wondered whether people had any particular understanding of inflation before it became a problem, and then they immediately said, "Well, it's prices." My impression was that there wasn't really.
There was always a.
I don't know the answer, so you can't
take. There was always some problems about inflation. And in fact, the Banking Act of 1844 was supposed to end inflation, but it didn't end the monopoly of money, of course, which allows inflation. Hayek, oddly enough, in his first book, Prices of Production, actually thought that there was no way out of it. Given the credit system, you had to have inflation, and he thought that once you had inflation, you would have the credit cycle. But then, in his celebrated...
By inflation, you mean increasing the money supply?
Yes. But then, this is what I meant. In his final denationalisation of money pamphlet, he actually did change his mind and thought that if you denationalise money, you could actually get rid of inflation. That was a change of mind. He thought it was intrinsic to the monopoly of money. He continued to hold the thesis that it was intrinsic to the monopoly of money.
An interesting sort of thing I came across recently by a group in the UK called the Money Reform Party. Sort of had this target of reforming money so that inflation is stuck at 0%. Sort of got me questioning if we have an Austrian system, for example, of a gold standard, arguably with a relatively fixed money supply, we will eventually get to a point where prices start to fall because productivity increases. But then I started thinking, well, how this idea of the deflationary spiral, at what point will this theory of the deflationary spiral and the reverse of it, I guess, is Mises' idea that at some point people will just start buying products. At what point will people start thinking, okay, money, the prices are going down, so why don't we just hold on to our gold-backed money to buy later on?
Well, first, I mean, you see people dealing with deflation all the time in particular prices like computers and cars, and it's no big problem. People just change the calculations. I think it probably depends on the individual time preferences, how they deal with this. I've always been quite sceptical about this deflationary spiral idea.
If obviously, as in America, in the 30s, if there's a loss, a third of the money stock just... because there were stupid restrictions on bank branches and other things. That was partly Canada, who had a more British system, had no bank failures, none, in the 1930s. And America had, whatever it might be, a lot, and they lost a third of the money stock. That's the point monetarists make. They miss out the rest of it, but they get that bit right. And it didn't help. In 1937, this is amazing, that the Fed found out that banks were keeping more than they needed to. They were keeping more than the required rate. They thought, look, we're in control here. We said you keep so much, you're keeping more than that much. Well, keep what you're keeping, but we're telling you. In other words, the government had to show it was in charge. So the bank then went, well, right, we'll do what you say, but we'll have our usual 10% more. And the available money fell again, and there was a recession within a recession in 1937. Bravo.
Weren't they parking their money with the Fed because they could earn higher rates with the Fed?
They're doing it now. Traditionally, you don't get any money from
them. No, they're not getting. They're only getting 0.25% or something at the Fed now. So now, it's much lower than they would get on the open market.
In Sweden, it's a negative rate. It's negative one now to encourage banks from sitting on their money.
They're getting higher rate.
They're punished. Yeah, they're getting punished.
The point is, he might be safe for the lending to someone.
It's getting risk for you.
That's the sad part. Yeah, it might actually be the case. Rothbard, incidentally, makes a point. No one else makes this point, so it's interesting. It could be untrue. But actually, Germany, despite the horror of the reparations and the sigh, they shouldn't be loaded with all these costs, they borrowed the money.
than the Americans to pay it. They never pay it back. They never pay it back. Oh, they were annoyed about it. I mean, it looked like taxes were paying it back. Oh, terrible. The evil of Versailles, but no, they didn't pay it back. Well, now the Britain went paid back inflated the money. And they actually finished only about 5 years ago, 8 years ago. They finally paid off one of the American war loans.
Yeah.
Just, you know, to look good, I suppose.
I mean, there is a theory that it was sort of partly deliberate, the German inflation, to avoid paying the reparations, but I'm not sure that's correct.
The moral, I'm not sure that.
Probably have mixed motives, but it didn't mind that it had that effect.
There is a... Sorry. I'd like to make an observation about taxes and inflation, actually. I mean, the Weimar Republic, being a progressive government, had progressive taxation. And you said it's hard to collect taxes. Well, what happens, of course, is initially that the cost of living goes up, wages have to follow, but the tax rates remain the same at the given levels, so therefore taxes increase incredibly rapidly. And therefore, rapidly becomes not worth working, not legally anyway. Of course, it also has other aspects. So people get behind with their taxes, and then officialdom then begins to oppress the people for not paying their taxes, and then you start having to bribe people to leave you alone and that sort of thing. And in fact, it's not just economic calculation which falls apart, the whole social business falls apart.
That's right, there's a huge rise in corruption all over the countries that were
experiencing inflation.
Yeah, but especially public officials, because their salaries tend to rise more slowly than those of unionised labour, for example, they became very susceptible to corruption.
That's an all bad.
Yeah, but they made up the slack. Worked in Angola for 3 years, on and off, and pretty massive inflation there. Definitely hyperinflation. What I found extraordinary, several things are extraordinary, but what I found, is that people kept on using money, even on the markets, which are illegal anyway. And the police and the army would come and try and break them up as they were operating. But even so, people used a bundle of banknotes, all which were stuck together because they were never separated. And God knows how much there was, but he used to go and buy bananas. I don't know all there was to sale. You had a pile of notes. You just chuck and look at your pile of notes and say, okay, you take your pile of notes and give him a banana. He's saying, oh God.
The trouble with Barter is that's a big coincidence of interest.
They were locking you into the banana cellar, but he's locked
it. Not that.
I think you need to ask some ice cream or something.
Does anyone know what has actually happened in Zimbabwe recently? They're obviously stopped producing the stuff.
They're trading in gold.
Yeah, that's
sensible. Or dollars, or
gold.
They have gold in this. Yeah.
Well, they're sort of mining.
Oh, well, I'm mining.
They broke the De Beers cartel and they started trading diamonds at the back door.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Well, the cans are bigger and all sorts of things.
Just deflation, just another thing, before we get out of inflation, is it possible we get deflation because of this? There's supposed to be a quadrillion notional derivatives out there that have been unsettled. The notional becomes real when people start defaulting, the counterparty starts defaulting. It's a hell, you know, the world's GDP is 50 trillion, we're talking about a quadrillion out there. I don't think you can ever print enough money to counteract it.
Yeah, I think when you balance them all off, I think it's much lower figure than that, but it's still immense.
But when the counterparty starts defaulting, I think it becomes actual, like dominoes.
Yeah, it's something I haven't looked at, to be honest, I think. And I'm not sure what the consequences will be.
That's an elephant.
Oh yes, it's not good. I think we should remember, as I said, is it dominoes or is it an elephant?
It's a fantastic set of dominoes.
The domino and the elephant.
Fantastic dominoes. Any fantastic dominoes.
The interesting thing is, the point, I tried to cheer people up back in a year or so ago, after Labour went under, and said, look, everything in the world is there. All the talents there, all the mineral resources are there, all the intellectual capital there, all the art treasures are there. Everything's still there.
We weren't falling ourselves, said the Americans, with the income, but the world's output was there. It was being agreed. It wasn't fake, it wasn't nonsense. A lot of Americans rationally borrowed a lot because they thought they were worth more and more. They answered, you have an amount. Why should I save? That's my pension, look at it. There's no need. Now, we now know they weren't getting richer and richer. They thought they were, but they weren't. But sorry, no, I don't know. It was silly ones like people who had no money were given the higher mortgages and all that, but that was a big part of it. But everything is still there. So when even with this default thing, in the end you have to go, well, unless you're sad enough to have had all your money, as it were, if you've got the stuff, the real stuff, still there, that's why property prices are probably going up. It's actually the one thing the company wiped out. Necessarily, because when inflation is immense go up, of course you'll get some bloody government put on rent control. Because the rents keep going up, yeah, but not in real terms, never mind. It's good for votes. We'll freeze the rents, you know, then the landlords get wiped out. Then I don't know, but at present, it's probably not so daft to have your money in property. To some extent.
I have heard that, especially in the States, that the banks are sort of holding on to properties rather than going through the repossessions process. So the sort of real flood of properties onto the market is being deliberately held off by the banks. I don't know to what extent that's happening here or not.
That could be wise, though, couldn't it? It wouldn't be for that very reason.
Yeah.
Of course, it's predicated on the assumption that you can make enough money to actually live on day to day. It's all very well having a house and having a family. You still need
the people who are renting the place need to have a job. So if the whole economy is so knocked sideways by country manipulation or printing it, then in the end, you're off to the forest. Whatever.
Stripping the truth.
To what extent is the problem caused by the legal tender laws which make us use the government currency? If anybody was simply allowed to use gold-backed notes independently, wouldn't people just move over to that to leave behind the inflation?
Yeah, the inflation money would.
Yeah, I don't think that's right.
They use their tax base.
They insist on being paid.
Well, they simply. Okay, yeah. The government could still insist on being paid with this new currency.
And then they can't control it because they're not issuing the currency because they have no idea how much is out.
They can't inflate the currency anymore.
Yeah, but that is their tax base. That's why they make it their currency.
So how do they use the tax base if you can still extort money from people because you've got a deficit state? Oh yeah, but you can't
inflate it.
Yeah, that's the whole idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Inflation is the best way
of making. They're not going to allow
it. It does more damage. Yeah, it does a lot.
Trade. I mean, I think there was a scenario somewhere in Eastern England where a small region started accepting euros for purely tourist reasons, but they started trading. But aren't legal tender laws only? Don't they only say that you must accept pounds as payment rather than prevent you trading with other currencies?
You must pay your taxes in pounds, yeah. And you cannot turn pounds down.
Yeah, so theoretically, we could trade gold-backed notes if the other person was able to accept.
That was actually made illegal in America. A lot of contracts in the 30s.
We couldn't insist on somebody paying us. They could say, well, we're going to pay you inflated currency.
You've
got to accept it.
That's what it does.
It does prevent that.
So, but theoretically, I guess, we could trade in euros and yen and all the rest of it. But if we were given pounds, we'd have to take them, right? According to legal tender laws.
There's some talk of a world currency. What they mean is a world fiat currency. They can depreciate at the same time altogether. So you can't fly to another currency.
Special drawing rights.
Bangkok comes back. They might try it on, I can't see that happening, but then they'd have to make gold illegal. Which they would, of course.
They're confiscated in 1933.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. It's 1973. The members of the IMF, it's been illegal to tie all currency to a metal.
Which was what Nixon defaulted in 71, yeah. Nixon defaulted.
Yeah.
The inflation was so massive in the 70s that Enoch Powell made a point of that.
Well, the Americans went off the gold standard. Why?
Yeah.
Well, that was the
main
problem. Enoch Powell made a point in the Commons in 1977. The problem in the oil in 1973 had been wiped out by inflation. I.e., it was cheaper by 1977 in real terms.
Well, the poor old greedy Arabs, in effect, were really catching up with...
That's why they're so appreciated. demand went up, of course. They were just trying to keep up with the fallen value. That's all.
Good for real money.
You can't say oil went out of oil.
Well, let me just say it's depreciated 95% or more in this country since whatever, 1910. Well, 13 in America, because that was
America. Yeah,
but over here. But it's even worse than that. Because up to about 1950, it wasn't a lot more than 1900, it was a bit. What would it be? A third, maybe?
Yeah.
Not a lot. But since then, it's done the other 80%.
I mean, the other problem is that, I mean, some researchers have tried to strip out the changes in the index as well. And if you do that, you find that inflation, the real sort of declining purchasing power has been rather more rapid than the official rate. And though it's a tricky subject area, but especially in the 90s and recently, though, there have been constant changes to the way it's been measured, the official index, CPI. And so you've got to look at that with suspicion. But there are terrible, if these guys are right, there are terrible implications, because it basically means the state has been more or less static for the last 20 years in terms of income. So obviously governments have got good reasons to sort of tinker with the figures.
Yeah. Yes, it's true. Men and women are out to work far more than before. Well, partners aren't at all, but those that are out there, and it's because they now have to. In a way it's good, I suppose. In some ways a woman can do produce more value out of the home, really. Especially if you have the machines to do a lot of the household work for you, but it's partly because they're now taxed so much.
Yeah.
The two of them together, they have to get out there. I feel they have to get out.
They feel they have to get out.
Also you have to carry the net taxpayers have to carry the others.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's thought to be a stimulus that we now have a greater ratio of non taxpayers to net taxpayers. Well, no, they're taxpayers, quotes. But a net taxpayer is an actual taxpayer. A non-net taxpayer doesn't pay any tax. They're paid in tax,
yeah.
Of which they return less
yes.
To the government. So, of course, they're not taxpayers.
Yes.
And this is thought to be a stimulus. We now have 110,000 more state employees than a year ago. And the private sector sunk by more than more.
200,000?
Especially up north. Up north, there's a lot of public sector, so-called public sector employees.
Yeah. Giving up demand. Actually, we don't hear that now. It's the oil sector. That their wages are automatic stabilisers. Giving up demand. Oh, yeah.
Well, I do think that it's a bit of a myth, but it's a convention, I think, that makes people feel they must, both man and wife, go out. So, I mean, I think if they wanted to start, if they wanted to run a situation where the man was the breadwinner, I think they'd do far better than the family did in the 1950s.
If there were no taxes, it's quite possible.
No, even with taxation.
I mean, they'd have to then, in terms of the property market, it's a problem there, because they'd end up in a terrible area, because they'd be competing in the sort of bid rent system with families from a lower social status on the same income. Then.
Yes, but I do think that they, if for example, if a family decided to, presently they've all decided since the 1950s for both parts of the couple to go out to work. But if they decided to go the traditional way and where the woman stopped at home, they'd be far better off now than they would have been their parents in the 1950s.
Yeah, they wouldn't be much better off than they would be on benefits though, unless they were...
But then again, you know, in realistic terms, the people on benefits are doing quite well.
Yeah.
In realistic terms.
I think the single ones, it's tough for them, but the ones with children, they're pretty well off these days.
Yes. See.
It's sort of part of the same subject, because some of the excuse for pumping this money out is that it's keeping up demand. It's a stimulus, this fiscal stimulus, which is a democratic wish list that they have for 20 years to spend on their pet projects and their pet special interest groups. Although in America, they're not actually doing it very much, because the AA... The half-term election is 2 years away, so that's when the money's got to really start kicking in 2 years' time, and you'll find it will. Also, it's difficult to spend a lot of money quickly. And they try, but it's not too easy. You've got to find people.
And this is the big joke with these fiscal stimulus packages that they can actually start getting going to.
There's a fiscal stimulus and there's a monetary stimulus, yeah. There's both. Now, It's a bit of the same subject. The greatest stimulus of the 20th century in America, in my view, was when the government sacked 11 million, more than 11 million, I think, many million servicemen and women, mostly men. They sack because you get no more wages. So all the income, the good demand. Must have been a horror story. Worse than that, the government cut taxes, cut expenditure enormously. It must have been a terrible depression. Of course, we know. Although it's said that the war ended and the American depression didn't at all. You know, before the unemployed are sent off to war, that doesn't make no sense. You don't get unemployed for. But what happened was that all this labour was working with capital, undeniably, machinery of destruction. Now, that might have been necessary. That's a separate argument. The point is, it sure isn't turning out. More stuff than it's worth, in a sense. You're just destroying things that work. Yes, humans and machinery and land, buildings. So when they were released to be absorbed back into mixing with another sort of capital, car plants, house building, where it might be, that was the biggest stimulus possible, because suddenly you were turning out greater value with the same people. They shifted from lower value to higher value production, and then they had more to spend. I mean, it's not spend, it's output. Output demands output.
But as before, you knew where you were. Unemployment was lower than Keynes thought it could possibly be.
Yes.
And not only that, you picked up a phone for a job, and the job almost come after you, you know.
Oh, well, factories would always have adverts outside. Men wanted shops to say, inquire within, lad wanted, woman wanted. You know. And that's not unnatural. That's what the world would be like without minimum wage and all the rest of it. But that's what the world would be like. There are more useful things for people, humans, to do than there are humans to do. That's the good news.
It's no bad news in terms of transaction costs, though, in terms of the percentage you're unemployable. So the problem with certain people...
There aren't that many unemployed. You'd be a paper eight.
They never talk about people being unemployable in the 1960s. No. It was a project that was virtually unknown. Anyone could get a job because the jobs were chasing the workers.
You could push a broom. You could keep your eye out. You could help load a lorry. Goodness. What can I do? And even now, we're still low, fetching carrion. You can sit and look at a TV screen and say, is someone robbing the store?
Well, that's how you wrote the book, Education Matters. She said, all this training isn't going to provide any work. But she knows one thing about the future. There'll be no shortage of demand for unskilled workers. You know, that's what Alison Wolfe said in Education Matters. I think she's got a bit of an hour there.
There's this silly idea that everyone has to have a degree. Of course everyone will.
Very good talk,
what we need is a good war.
What you need is a big war. But of course, I thought Bob was completely crystal clear when he made the point that it was the stimulus after the war, by getting rid of the wasteful war budgets that produced a fantastic boom that reached its peak in the 1960s, not in the 1950s so much. It was what destroyed it, of course, is that stupid Wilson with his bloody selective employment tax.
But Richard has pointed out...
I'm talking about a recipe for causing unemployment. We're going to have a selective employment tax.
Country the hairdressers. Now, Richard has pointed out that the official figures in America show that GNP or GDP fell 45-46, which it may have done. But there are silly conventions whereby to find out how much value the state turns out, you take all the wages and add 2% or more. Well, hang on. All of them? Mere permission givers? Mere people who say, carry on doing something useful? No. They're quite immediately shut off. All right, maybe it's 6 months, 12 months. Doesn't matter. But people were immediately eating better, dressing better, more petrol, so it It's hard to say that Alpha wasn't parcels, but it sounds like that.
Well, here, not here, here, over here, we're living on parcels. I couldn't have sweets got three.
You've made that.
Yeah, I made that.
Well done, Richard.
Okay, thank you very much, Richard.
The bathroom?
Yes, I don't think it's shut yet.
It's not till 10.
We went to the pub because he shot last time.
Yeah.
I think it's not good.